Blog Talk Radio.
Aaron McCready.
Fox News Radio, I'm Kathleen Maloney. A shakeup in the president-elect transition team.
Vice President-elect Mike Pence will take on the role of chairman of the transition, replacing New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Christie remains on board as vice chair. The move was painted as a chance to use Pence's Washington experience to build a team, but may have also stemmed from last week's conviction of two of Governor Christie's subordinates in the Bridgegate scandal.
Fox's Doug McElway, those two former aides, Bridget Kelly and Bill Baroni, are seeking new trials. Testimony contradicted Christie's denial of knowledge or involvement in the closing of lanes at the George Washington Bridge for political revenge. Protesters in Miami unhappy with the results of the presidential election. Demonstrations are going on in several cities again, also in Israel.
As an American living abroad, it is still important for me to show my solidarity with people who are living in fear currently in the United States. Just because the distance is there, it doesn't make me any less of an American. It doesn't take my right away from expressing what I feel.
A few dozen protesters demonstrated outside the American Embassy in Tel Aviv. The stock market continues to react positively to the election results.
After a presidential election, it will go down in the history books. The Dow itself making some history today. More than a few analysts have predicted a Donald Trump presidential victory would push the financial markets into freefall. They were wrong. Trump's pro-growth proposals have pushed stocks to record highs, but it has been a big week for drug and biotech stocks. Now there's no threat of Hillary Clinton's price control plans. The Nasdaq Biotechnology Index recorded its biggest weekly gain in 16 and a half years.
Fox Business Network's Ashley Webster, the Dow gained 39 points to close at a record high. You're listening to Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
This is a test to find out if you know it all when it comes to children. Time starts now. Name one of the leading killers of U.S. children age 1 to 13. What's the best way to protect children in a car crash? At what age and size should a child start using a booster seat? Where can you find the answers to these questions?
Car crashes are one of the leading killers of U.S. children. Many of those deaths could be prevented by making sure that kids are in the right seat for their age and size. Don't assume you know it all when it comes to car seats for your child. Go to safercar.gov/the right seat and know for sure. That's safercar.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
More than 30 protesters are arrested at the scene of the Dakota Access Pipeline.
North Dakota Highway Patrol Lieutenant Tom Iverson said they
conducted riot activities by vandalizing equipment, breaking up windows, cutting wires inside of the construction equipment.
Separately, there's tension between the Army Corps of Engineers, which permitted the pipeline project, and Energy Transfer Partners, which is building it. The Corps has asked for a temporary stop to construction to diffuse tension with protesters. Energy Transfer says they'll do that if they get a date by which they can complete construction. The Corps suspended construction in September in this area to review its permitting process, and Friday reportedly said they'd have a final decision in the next few days. Jessica Rosenthal, Fox News.
A top Republican is asking President-elect Donald Trump to move ahead quickly to approve another controversial pipeline. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he spoke to Mr. Trump about it during their meeting on Capitol Hill yesterday. President Obama vetoed legislation that would have moved that project ahead. On this day of remembering American service members, the Veterans Affairs Department says it is making improvements in their health system.
A VA report says it's processed 1 million more appointments than last year and 3 million more than in 2014. VA Secretary Bob McDonnell says the department is making it easier for veterans to sign up for services.
Now, what have we seen? Well, we've got over 1 million new veterans signed up in our health care system.
One of President-elect Donald Trump's campaign promises was to create a private White House hotline that would be staffed around the clock. In Washington, Rachel Sutherland,
Fox News.
A political change of heart at Grubhub. The co-founder of the food delivery service retracting an email suggesting that employees who supported President-elect Trump should resign. He's now tweeting that the company is proud of all its employees. I'm Kathleen Maloney, Fox News Radio.
You have read about him in the Huffington Post. You have seen him quoted in Esquire magazine. The Washington Post writes about him, and you saw him on MSNBC. This is Aaron McCready. Give Aaron a call at 646-200-3400. That's 646-200-3400. Also follow him on Twitter at Aaron McCready or visit him on the web at AaronMcCready.com.
Welcome to the show, everyone. I am Aaron McCready. It's great to have you on board with us. And first of all, before we start, I just want to wish everyone a very, very happy Veterans Day. Without all of our great veterans, it would not be possible for all of us to be here where we are right now. So to our veterans, I give you a big thank you. So thank you to everyone, men and women. You know, some people, they don't realize the difference between Veterans and Memorial Day. And so just to give you, before we start, a quick difference of Veterans and Memorial Day. Veterans Day remembers all veterans that served in the military. And Memorial Day, it memorializes or remembers the people that died in combat, gave the ultimate sacrifice for our freedom. And, you know, some of us here in the United States take that for granted, our freedom. But go to other countries, go visit them, come back, and you'll appreciate that a whole lot more. We're going to get into that a little bit later with all the protests that are going on. And, you know, it's been a very controversial week. We had a big week, and we're going to talk about that here in just a little bit. But first, just to pay the bills, and then we'll get on with the show, thecampaignedge.com. Go to thecampaignedge.com if you ever want to run for office or need any promotional materials. The campaign season is actually getting ready to rev back up again. We had 2 years of the presidential campaign. So, you know, if you're thinking about running for office or you need any promotional materials, go to thecampaignedge.com.
Candidates, campaign managers, and activists. It's election season, and when a candidate is running for office, from the local city commission all the way to president of the United States, getting their name etched in the mind of voters is the key to victory. And the best way to do that is to cover the area with promotional materials from thecampaignedge.com. Thecampaignedge.com will provide your candidate or cause with everything you need to win, from bumper stickers to magnetic car signs, buttons, tents, flags, and much more. With the help of thecampaignedge.com, you will have your name or slogan all over town. So when voters walk into that voting booth and look at the names and issues on the ballot, they will recognize yours right away. When you order from thecampaignedge.com, use the coupon code VIP and receive a 10% discount. Go to thecampaignedge.com and start on the road to victory. thecampaignedge.com.
All right, as I was saying, this week's been a big week. We elected Donald Trump as our new president, and that was an upset victory. Going into Tuesday, he was behind in the polls. And when the results started coming back and we saw the map and it was going red with just a little bit of blue, and, you know, it was Hillary Clinton's race to lose. She was ahead going in, and I knew that if she did not put it away early, if they did not call her the winner early, that the further it went into the night, that it will probably go toward Donald Trump. And sure enough, it did. 270 electoral votes is what you need to win the presidency. And he went past that. I think he had 290 total to end. I think without me looking at it, Hillary ended up with 224. But a lot of people wonder what the Electoral College is and why the Electoral College matters so much when we actually go to the polls and vote. Hillary actually won by 400,000 votes if you look at the popular vote, meaning you and I vote at the individual votes that count. But in the Electoral College, and it's only happened now five times in our history, the last time it happened was in the year 2000 when Al Gore won the popular vote, and then George W. Bush became president because of the Electoral College. But just real quick, and bear with me, I think we need to clear this up because a lot of people seem to be upset and are rioting. They say Hillary got the most votes, and some are rioting because they just don't agree with Donald Trump. But this tells you a little bit about the Electoral College, and then we'll talk about it here in just a second.
What is the Electoral College? In a nutshell, it is a layer of bureaucracy between your vote and who becomes president. At the Constitutional Convention in 1787, the Founding Fathers were trying to devise a balanced way to elect a president. They didn't want the president to be selected solely by a group of political elites like Congress or the state legislature, and they were a little terrified at the idea of a direct popular election, since there was no telling who the idiot masses might pick. So they came up with a compromise, the Electoral College. Each state has electors in the college equal to the number of members it has in Congress. Every state has two senators and a delegation in the House of Representatives based on its population. Since California is the largest state, it has the most representatives with 53, plus two senators, and that gives it 55 electors. Whereas Hawaii only has two representatives and two senators, giving it four electors. Even though it has no representatives at all, Washington, D.C. also gets three electors. That gives us a grand total of 538 possible electoral votes. Each political party has its own slate of electors. 538 Democrat electors, 538 Republican, 538 for the Green Party, and so on. The selection of these electors is controlled by the political parties, and how they are chosen varies state to state. When you place your vote in November, you aren't actually voting for the president. You are voting for an elector from your district who represents the political party of your candidate. In all but two states, this is a winner-take-all system, meaning that if the majority of a state's districts vote for one candidate, all of the state electors in that candidate's political party get to vote. So a candidate who wins the majority in New York State will get all 29 of their electors in that state. This winner-take-all system was not how the process was originally envisioned by the founders, but rather a change in the state law made in an effort by party leaders to maximize support for their preferred candidate. Once one state went this route, the rest quickly followed. All except Nebraska and Maine, where the state winner gets two electors and the winner of each congressional district receives one elector. This system allows electors to be awarded to more than one candidate, and some may argue is a much better way of representing the population's vote than a winner-take-all model. Or maybe not, since the districts of many states have been totally mangled through gerrymandering, which are political campaigns to rearrange legislative districts to make sure they reliably vote one way or the other. Regardless, once all the votes are in and the electors from each state have been determined, those electors then go and vote for their pledged delegate. A majority of 270 electoral votes is required to elect the president. Theoretically, this system was originally intended to allow electors to act as independent actors and determine whether the public was truly choosing a worthy president. And so, there is no constitutional provision or federal law requiring electors to vote according to the results of the popular vote in their states. However, throughout our history as a nation, more than 99% of electors have voted as pledged. And though there have been electors who broke ranks as recently as the 2000 election, their votes have never influenced the outcome of a presidential election.
So there you have it. That is the Electoral College. And one thing that they didn't mention in the clip here, why it's so important to have an Electoral College is so everyone is actually represented. That way the candidates, say Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, they don't go into New York City or Houston or L.A. or Miami and create packages to win votes for those big cities. And then, therefore, the rest of the population in the rural communities in, say, areas of Kansas, you know, Wisconsin, even Texas, that they're left out. So that way each state has those electorates, and that way that's what you're voting for. It makes it actually a lot more even, fairer for everyone. And so those big cities don't choose their president each year, especially if you don't agree with the person that's winning. And we're going to get to Donald Trump right now and what his administration will look like. And there are several key positions up for grabs right now. And with his team, and he's actually named his family, his children, and then one of his son-in-laws to the transition team. And they're actually trying to figure out who they want on the cabinet. Huge decision. And right now, as you may have heard earlier in the news, New Jersey Chris Christie was leading that up during the election, but now Vice President-elect Mike Pence is actually heading the transition team. And the transition team is so important for the future of our country. The current president's administration, President Obama, meets with Donald Trump's team, and once the positions become filled with who Donald Trump wants, they start working together with the And even right now, they're working together with the Obama administration to ensure a smooth transition of the government, of the executive branch. That's when the United States is the most vulnerable. Back when Clinton became president, we were attacked. And then, of course, we all know September 11th, we were attacked in the first few months of the George W. Bush administration. So it's so important. And even Obama has said it's important for us to have an easy transition. And distracting from some of the transitions and the news of who's going to be what are some of these violent protests. And I just want to stop and talk about the violent protests for just a second. The other day, I guess 3 days ago, when Trump was elected president, people started protesting that night, and it's still going to this day. Well, I do have something to say to those protesters. The protesters that are destroying people's property. I saw a video today, and there's a whole gang of them, walking down the street, and they're passing a brand new car dealership. And you know what they do with baseball bats? There's no one there at the car dealership. They go and start smashing the windshields. You know, everyone has the right to protest. That's what makes America so great. In fact, that's what makes us stronger as a country. The right to protest, to get out ideas. It takes a little bit from here and a little bit of there, and then we come together, and it makes the country stronger. But these people that are protesting, these thugs, these people that are protesting, destroying people's property, causing fights with innocent people because they're upset that Donald Trump became president. You know, these are probably the same people that protested Wall Street, started acting up on the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, if those people, and I'm being kind by saying those people, if those people put those efforts and their smarts into doing something good for the country, actually trying to make a difference, we'll be far better off. But instead, most of these people have no jobs. They're living in mom and dad's basement. And then they see an opportunity to, they say, try to make a difference or protest an election that half of them didn't even vote in. Maybe if they would have voted in this election, maybe Hillary Clinton would be president. Maybe they would have gotten what they wanted. Maybe if they took and became an active member of the political process, who's today that we celebrate Veterans Day for the people that fought and died and gave the ultimate sacrifice and lost their limbs and bodies riddled with bullets and suffered to protect your freedom to protest. Maybe if you took part in the political process, maybe your candidate would have won. Maybe if you would be a member of society that actually contributed a little bit rather than living off the government or living off mom and dad, maybe you could have made a difference. But now the cause that you so greatly say that you're for, you're making a mockery of it. And I'm probably talking to myself, I know, but that's how it is. I mean, my goodness, just take a listen to what ABC News' Marcy Gonzalez reported.
We reject the president-elect!
A second night of anti-Trump protests in cities across the country. Violent. In Portland, police say a rally turned into a riot when demonstrators started vandalizing vehicles and buildings, throwing things at police, and blocking this bridge.
Take over the intersection!
And a major freeway in Los Angeles was shut down by crowds of people angry about the election results.
If I had one message for Trump, it would be that we are the people and we want our voices to be heard and we will not stand down.
Donald Trump responded on Twitter, first writing last night, just had a very open and successful presidential election. Now professional protesters incited by the media are protesting. Very unfair. Then changing his tune this morning, tweeting, love the fact that the small groups of protesters last night have passion for our great country. We will all come together and be proud. Trump now back in New York City, where concrete barriers and sanitation trucks serving as barricades are set up outside of his home at Trump Tower, and a no-fly zone is in place within a two-mile radius. Authorities working to overcome the challenge of protecting the president-elect in the nation's busiest city.
How do you build a secure bubble around him when he's several feet in the air with other potential buildings where a sniper or somebody else could potentially place themselves?
And like at the White House, there's now 24-hour Secret Service coverage throughout Trump Tower, whether Trump is there or not. Meanwhile, across the country, more protests are planned for tonight. Marcy Gonzalez, ABC News, New York.
You know, we had the ultimate protest. When we went to the ballot box, that was the protest. If you voted for Hillary Clinton, you protested Donald Trump. If you voted for Donald Trump, you protested Hillary Clinton. The election's over. We selected our president. End of story, period. Now, if you want to start protesting once he becomes president because of his ideas or what he's doing, by all means, go ahead. Protest peacefully. That's what makes America great. But to start protesting just because your candidate lost or who you thought needed to win, it's ridiculous. You know, that's really all I'm going to talk about when it comes to that, because the more I talk about it, the more aggravated I get, and it gives them the power. And by all means, they don't deserve that. Not when they're causing havoc, when they're breaking windows, destroying businesses that people work so hard for. I don't know. But anyways, moving on. We do have President Trump, and from day one, I supported him. And I knew that he was the right man for the job, and I was one of the very few that stood out and said, Donald Trump will be our next president. Donald Trump's what we need. Donald Trump will make a difference. And I'm not just on the Donald Trump bandwagon. Back on August 2nd, of last year, I actually endorsed Donald Trump. Let's take a listen to that show back August 2nd, 2015. But it's something I'm very passionate about, this country. Donald Trump's passionate about it too. That's why I endorsed him for President of the United States. That was back August 2nd of 2015. So now he is trying to pick his Secretary of State, Treasury Secretary, Secretary of Defense, Attorney General. And I'm going to go down the list real quick. This will be quick. We only have about 5 minutes before the news break. And Secretary of State, he hasn't named any of these yet. But from what I hear and my sources say and my contacts in Washington and in New York around Trump Tower, Secretary of State could go to either former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. It could go to Bob Corker. He's a Tennessee senator, Senator Bob Corker. He's also chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And it could go to John Bolton. He's the former ambassador to the United Nations. He was that under George W. Bush. who I think it will be, I think it's either between Newt Gingrich or John Bolton. I think Bob Corker is out. I think Trump realizes that image is everything, and especially when you go to foreign countries, and their thoughts on how you should present yourself are far different from ours. People that they see in power and the image of the people in power are far different than ours. And I think Trump realizes that, and Bob Corker is a tiny man. If he walks in, I don't know that some countries would take him seriously. So I think Bob Corker, we can knock him out of Secretary of State. So I think it's between Newt Gingrich, former House Speaker from the great state of Georgia, and John Bolton, former ambassador to the UN. Now, Treasury Secretary is going to go to Steven Mnuchin. He's a former Goldman Sachs executive. He already said he wanted them for that position. So I think Treasury Secretary will go to him. And, you know, the cabinet positions are very important, too. They have these different departments. And in the event, God forbid, that the president, the vice president, are killed, of course it goes to the Speaker of the House. They become president. But then there is a line of succession that goes after that, and some of the cabinet posts are in there. That's why when we have the State of the Union, one person sits out. They're away from the building because you have the president, you have the vice president, you have all members of Congress, everyone is in there. And so they keep one cabinet post out in case the catastrophic might happen. The Secretary of Defense, I think it's probably going to go to Jeff Sessions. He's Senator from Alabama. He's been a Trump supporter like myself and like Sean Hannity from day one. Attorney General, that's going to be an easy one. That's either going to be Rudy Giuliani or Chris Christie. My take on it is going to be Rudy Giuliani. Interior Secretary, that's a tough one. That's either going to be either the co-founder of Lucas Oils, Forrest Lucas, which having the name Forrest and being the Department of the Interior, also in charge of our national parks, that would be fitting. But also, there's a little bit of an outsider. People don't see this coming. She's also supported him from day one, even over Ted Cruz, and that is former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin. She could be Secretary of the Interior. So either Forrest Lucas, founder of Lucas Oils, or it's going to be former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin. Now, Agriculture Secretary, which I'm actually excited about this one. So, Texas, where I am at now, and Georgia, where I lived for many years and still love that state, it's going to be either Texas Secretary of Agriculture, Sid Miller. He is the current Secretary of Agriculture here in Texas. Or, and I've interviewed him before, he's been shoulder to shoulder with me, sitting right beside me, former Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue. So it's either going to be Sonny Perdue or Sid Miller. So either one of those will be great choices for the Department of Agriculture. Real quick, we're running out of time before the news. Commerce Secretary, you could either say that there's four or five people actually up for grabs on this one. So the Commerce Secretary, it's either going to be Wilbur Ross, I think is his name. Wilbur Ross. He's an investor. And then also could be Texas Governor Rick Perry. And also some people are saying Mike Huckabee's in for it and also Chris Christie. So out of those, I would say if it's going to be Commerce Secretary, if Chris Christie is not the Attorney General, then he's going to be the Commerce Secretary. Rudy Giuliani used to be a former federal prosecutor, so he could be the Attorney General. And then Chris Christie could be the Commerce Secretary. So let's go with that. We'll say Chris Christie, Commerce Secretary. We'll say Rudy Giuliani, the Attorney General. And then Health and Human Services, this is going to be a no-brainer here. It's either going to be Rick Scott. He's a current governor of Florida. He also used to be a CEO of a major hospital there. Or Ben Carson, Dr. Ben Carson. We all know him. He ran for president. He's one of the top brain surgeons in the United States. So if I had to pick between the two because of his loyalty to Trump, I would say Dr. Ben Carson. And then Continental Resources CEO Harold Hamm, Department of Energy. And they say Ben Carson's also in the running for Secretary of Education. So if you have Rick Scott, Health and Human Services, you could put Ben Carson for Department of Education. And then Jeff Miller, He is in Congress, head of the Veterans Affairs, and I think he will be running the VA. And then Homeland Security, people are saying David Clark, he's a conservative sheriff from Milwaukee. He may be the Homeland Security chief there. And then the EPA, not a lot of people know about this one. Carol Comer is her name, and she was Indiana Department of Energy Management in charge of that, appointed by Vice President Mike Pence. So that's who we have for the cabinet. I know I went through it really quick. I probably bored you, but it's very important, very, very important that these get selected and then also get through the Senate confirmation hearings, which should be no problem. Since the Senate and the House, they're both Republican-controlled, along with the presidency come January. We are going to be right back after this news break.
Fox News Radio, I'm Kathleen Maloney. 3 days after the election, protests against the results continue in cities across the country.
I'm out here because I'm a woman, and I'm a bisexual, and I strongly believe that this country did not elect Donald Trump. The popular vote was for Hillary Clinton, and today we're out here to show that we will not take this lying down.
That protester at a demonstration in Miami, Florida. Protesters are again outside Trump Tower in New York City, where police and the Secret Service are taking extra security measures to protect the president-elect. The building on Fifth Avenue is surrounded by concrete barricades and an army of officers. President-elect Trump may start getting presidential daily briefings, known as PDBs, as soon as next week.
The PDB is like a highly classified newspaper for the president, containing only the most important global events and credible intelligence. Mr. Obama is the first president to routinely take the PDB electronically on his iPad. This is a dramatic break from past practice, which included one-on-one briefings. In the late summer, the president directed the intelligence community to give the winner full access to the PDB to ensure a smooth transition.
Fox's Catherine Herridge in Washington. Vice President-elect Mike Pence is taking over as head of the president-elect's transition team. He replaces New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who will remain on the team but not as chairman. He's joined on the executive committee by former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, Dr. Ben Carson, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, and Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions. A post-election rally continues on Wall Street, the Dow climbing 38 points to close at a record high, also posting its biggest weekly percentage increase in 5 years. NASDAQ gained 28 points, S&P slipped 3. Fox News Radio, they are in balance.
First opened about 10 years ago, we were small, just a few of us, but it was exciting. I always dreamt of having my own business. It was kind of slow at first, but things started picking up. We had big plans, but in our wildest dreams, we never, never thought we'd have this much work. Yeah, with so many businesses caught off guard by the storm, Reed Waste Management has never been busier.
What will become of your business after a disaster? Nearly two-thirds of businesses aren't prepared for an emergency, and 40% of businesses that experience a disaster never recover. Make an emergency plan now, before it's too late. For a free online tool that helps you develop an emergency plan to keep your business up and running should disaster strike, visit ready.gov/business. Brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the American Red Cross, and the Ad Council.
There are new reports of public killings and other atrocities committed by ISIS against civilians in Mosul. The bodies of dozens of people were hung from telephone poles after they were accused of using cell phones to leak information to Iraqi security forces. ISIS is also said to be using civilians as human shields. At least six people are dead after an attack in Afghanistan claimed by the Taliban.
Shopkeepers cleaning up debris after a suicide car bomber rammed the German consulate compound in northern Afghanistan. At least 120 others were wounded. A five-hour-long gun battle ensued. The attackers were fought off by consulate security personnel. German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier says all German and Afghan employees have been accounted for and are unharmed. The violence destroyed the Mazar Hotel, where the consulate is located. There has been an uptick in attacks by the Taliban and other insurgent groups in Afghanistan since the withdrawal of U.S. and NATO combat forces at the end of 2014. In the Mideast Bureau, Jessica Gallagher, Fox News.
Actor Robert Vaughn has passed away after a brief battle with leukemia. He was 83.
Vaughn's career achievements was a long list of film and television hits, but it was his role as a James Bond-esque spy in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. that was most notable.
There's a gala ball at the United Nations next week.
Vaughn also starred in The A-Team, The Nanny, The Coronation, and The Magnificent Seven. He earned an Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actor. Michelle Polino, Fox News.
Robert Redford is just about done with acting. In an online interview, the 80-year-old star says after he completes two acting projects already in progress, he'll focus on directing. Redford won an Oscar for directing Ordinary People in 1981, and he won an honorary Oscar in 2002. I'm Kathleen Maloney, Fox News Radio.
You have read about him in the Huffington Post. You have seen him quoted in Esquire magazine. The Washington Post writes about him, and you saw him on MSNBC. This is Aaron McCrady. Give Aaron a call at 646-200-3400. That's 646-200-3400. Also follow him on Twitter at Aaron McCrady or visit him on the web at aaronmccrady.com.
Welcome back, everyone. Glad you're back with us. If you're just tuning in, we talked about some of Trump's possible appointments to his cabinet and then a little bit what's going on around the country with the protesters. And, you know, I started to think with these protests that are going on and the violence and just the terrible things, breaking car windows, you know, trying to damage pipelines that you heard in the news in the top of the hour. You know, where are the parents of these individuals? I mean, who brought them up? Who taught them the basics in life to respect each other? You can have protests. That's what makes America great, but not violent protests. Don't go out and damage other people's property, ruin businesses, because you think it's okay. You know, so I was thinking, and we're going to take a break from politics for a second and just focus on families. Because I think right now, more than anything, that's what we really need, is to bring the country back a little bit, ground us again on things that actually really, really matter. And so my next guest is Bill McCusker. He is founder and CEO of a nonprofit called Fathers and Families. He also has a book called Fatherhood in Pieces, Wisdom and Advice from Fathers for Fathers. Bill, welcome to the show.
Hey, Aaron. It's great to be here. Thank you.
You know, I can't help but think, you know, when we see these protesters out there, what their home life might be like. And I was doing some research, and I don't know if I have old statistics or not, but about 23 or 24% of U.S. children live in father-absent homes. That's 17.4 million about. Why is it so important for there to be a father role model in the home?
Well, I think it's very important, and I think it links to some of the issues that you see that you have commented on, issues that are unfolding now. You know, it also, I think, fatherlessness relates to many other issues that people are concerned about. You know, things like poverty and hunger and income inequality and racial disparity and even things like obesity and unemployment and low self-esteem and so forth. A lot of these kind of maladies, I think, can be traced to a couple of root causes. And I think that's what people really want to get to. Like, what are the root causes of some of the problems that we see? And I think you hit one. You know, the fact that you do have 17.4 million kids that are living without a father, you know, if you look at the numbers, that's roughly the total population of New Mexico, Arkansas, West Virginia, Mississippi, Nevada, Nebraska, and Kansas. that wow. number of kids living without a dad. One of the things that I think directly leads to, and I know people can debate cause and effect forever, but, you know, children living in female-headed homes with no spouse present have a poverty rate of close to 48%. And that's according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. That's more than four times the rate of children living in married couple families. So do you think there's going to be a negative effect? Well, there's one person who saw a negative effect. Back in 2008 in a speech, he said, and let me quote this, children who grow up without a father are five times more likely to live in poverty and commit crime, nine times more likely to drop out of schools, and 20 times more likely to end up in prison. And that was Senator Barack Obama back in 2008. So I think we'd have to surmise, and you can look at facts galore. I think this is well-researched in terms of what the root cause of fatherlessness has caused in terms of so many of these problems. But I think that, along with maybe the scarcity of education choices, quality education, I think that's one of the big things that we need to address. It's a tough one. A lot of people don't want to talk about it, but I think it's one of the big ones that we need to take on.
Well, what prompted you, what encouraged you, what, I guess, spoke to you to really invest your time and energy in fatherhood and reaching out to people? This is a big undertaking and not something a lot of people would even try to take on.
Yeah, I guess a lot of people are smarter than I am in taking this on. Sometimes it's like pushing a rock uphill. But, you know, it started a while ago. I started working on what I thought was going to turn into a book. I started doing some research by talking to 35 individual fathers. I began with one interview, and that interview led to the second, to the third, and up to 35. These were one-on-one interviews with individual men. The only criteria is that you had to be a father, and you had to have been doing a good job, not a perfect job, but at least you were taking the role of fatherhood seriously. And I wound up talking to these 35 guys just with the idea that perhaps I could glean some, you know, wisdom and insight and perspective from them that I could share with other people. Now, why? You know, I wanted to learn myself. I learned a whole lot in talking to these fathers. In fact, the first sentence of the book is, I wish I read this book 20 years ago. So it was selfish. I wanted to learn more about fatherhood. You know, I have two daughters. I've been married for 40 years. You know, we've been very blessed in many ways, but I think particularly in the teen years, you know, we started facing some family issues. I don't think they were out of the ordinary. There were probably issues that, you know, most people face. But, you know, I began to think, you know, this parenting thing, this is hard, you know. that old cliche about parenting being a tough job, well, it's more than just a cliche. And I began to think, well, what about an increasingly large number of young men, and young women for that matter, who don't have fathers? Where do they learn about fatherhood? You know, as I was struggling with some of the issues that we were facing, I thought about my own dad, and I said, well, you know, he's been gone for a while now, but I said, well, how would dad handle something like this? You know, he was always a source of wisdom for me. He was mm-hmm. not a perfect man by any stretch, but, you know, he had a lot of ideas that were worth listening to. And I asked myself, you know, how would dad handle this? I also, you know, looked at siblings and, you know, friends and other folks, other fathers, you know, who were perhaps dealing with some of the same issues. So I had those resources. I had a good dad. I have a good mom. I could call on those resources, but I guess I increasingly wondered, well, all these kids increasingly that don't have a dad, where do they get their perspective on fatherhood? How do they learn what fatherhood is all about, what it means to be a father? So I guess I didn't delude myself into thinking that, you know, these millions of kids that don't have dads, suddenly they're going to pick up my book and learn, you know, everything they need to know. But I guess it was, you know, perhaps trying to have an impact on the lives of other people who are trying to learn about fatherhood or even parenthood for that matter, because I think there's a lot here that crosses the genders. But, you know, I thought, well, in addition to learning myself, perhaps I can, you know, help a few people along the way. So that was the genesis of the book.
Well, what about, you know, we talked, you know, 17.4 million children live in a home that are, the fathers are absent. You know, in those 17.4 million people, I'm sure there are very good mothers. And but what is the difference between a caring mother that is, you know, does everything for their children that has no father there present? What does can the father bring into that to help these, you know, these children succeed through life? What will be the difference between, you know, just what a child receives from the single mother as opposed to what they receive from also having a father?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And I guess it depends on your point of view. I happen to think that there's a lot missing. Not everyone feels that way. A little historical perspective might be helpful. You know, if you go back to 1965, there was a guy named Daniel Patrick Moynihan. You may remember that name. He was a liberal intellectual senator from New York. He wrote a pretty influential paper back in 1965 about what he called a ticking time bomb. He said there's a big problem, and it's going to go off, and it's going to mean a world of hurt, particularly for African Americans, because the rate of fatherlessness among blacks had risen to this alarmingly high percentage. It was back in 65. That percentage was 25%. Now, among blacks, it's over 72%. And lest your listeners think that I'm making a racial comment, back then in 65, I think among whites, it was 8%. So he was looking at the difference between 8 and 25. And he was saying, you know what, for blacks, this is going to mean an extraordinary a number of problems in terms of education, in terms of economics and equality and employment and all the rest. Well, the fatherless rate among whites now, I think, is in the 30s. So, you know, over four times what it was, you know, back in 65. So we didn't exactly listen to old Moynihan. And now we're, as a country, in the 40s in terms of percent of kids living without a dad. Now, your question, though, remains, well, so what? Well, I think the so what is some of the statistics that we looked at before, but there's also something else. Some moms, and I try to tell people, look, I'm not in the business of bashing single mothers. You know, some of those women do heroic work, and they raise absolute rock stars. And I'm not saying that, you know, two parents or a loving mom and a loving dad living in a family is a guarantee of anything. There's no guarantees. You know, they could raise the axe murderers. But if you look at the statistics, those that we cited and a lot more than that, all things being equal, you have to conclude that kids are better off with a mom and a dad. Now, the fact that that sounds somewhat controversial is somewhat mystifying, because I think that's a lesson we learned as a race of people, the human race, over the millennia. You know, that the best way, not a perfect way, but the best way to raise a kid is in a family with a mom and a dad. Well, sometimes
right.
What does the father bring
that the mother doesn't? You know what I mean?
Well, sometimes if I looked at, you know, if I go back to the book, I talked to the dads about that. I said, tell me about your spouse. Tell me about your wife. What are the differences? Sometimes the roles are somewhat distinct. Sometimes the roles are very much overlapping. I think we like to see where they're complementary, where moms and dads working together, you know, figure out, well, what do you do, what do I do, and how do we do this together? You know, at the very least, there's an arithmetic equation. I think two is better than one. You know, it takes a lot of time and effort and care and feeding and money to raise a kid from the time he or she is a newborn to the time, you know, they're leaving the house, you know, prepared to enter the world. Well, at least two is better than one. You know, from a discipline standpoint, from an attention standpoint, just the love that two parents, I think, are better equipped. you know, there are species of animals, for crying out loud. If one of the, I think ospreys as an example, you know, if one of the parents dies, the fledgling doesn't live, right? Because it takes a lot of work in terms of securing
right.
food and defending the baby bird. Well, I think as human beings, we're at least as complex an organism as a bird. And it just
right.
for one person, when he or she has to do it, and there are going to be occasions when, you know, there's just no choice, and they have to do the best they can. But unfortunately, Aaron, I think what has happened is that for a lot of people has become the norm, or at least it's become neutral. That hey, you can have a dad if you want, but dads are largely optional, and even more, maybe they're obsolete. Maybe they're dispensable now. And maybe it's a role we don't need a father for. Maybe we give it to a nanny, or we give it to the government, or we give it to a government agency. And I think we're doing kids a terrible disservice by having that mindset. I think we know better than that, but I think we've lost perhaps the courage that we need to tell the next generation, you know, look, you can call us judgmental if you want, or whatever bad things you want to say about us, but you know what? You know, we've learned a few things over the years, and two is better than one at the very least. So
right.
that's a long-winded way of answering your question.
No, you did good. On your site, you know, you mentioned fathersandfamilies.com. On your site, you have some videos. And if I could have your permission to play about 30 seconds from one of the videos, I just want to get your take on this and then why it's so important. It's I think it's titled A Special Gift is Loving Their Mother. And I want to play this for our audience, just to give them a clip of what they can see on your website. Take a listen.
I think the what I heard a priest talk about a while ago was the best gift we could give our children is to love their mother. And the best gift a mother can give, obviously, first and conversely, is to love their father. It's probably the best example we could give our children. And then trying to provide a loving, caring home that helps them become well-established people as they get older.
Why is that so important also? I mean, you know, you see, you know, fathers that may be there, but the, you know, children are very observant, and they may not notice things may not be going so well between mom and dad. Why is it so important that they see that the mother and father love each other so much?
Well, you know, one thing I think most of us know instinctively, and I certainly had it reinforced doing the research for the book, you learn a lot from your parents. You know, most of the fathers that I talked to said that their fathers, and that was one of the questions I had, their fathers left an indelible mark on them, for the most part. Fortunately, most of the time that was a positive impression. Sometimes it was not a positive one. But I think, you know, we have to know, as fathers, we have to know that our kids are looking at us. And they take patterns, for better or worse, they take patterns that they have seen and learned into their teen years and into their adult lives. You know, how we handle our relationships as fathers with our wives, how we deal with the conflicts that inevitably, you know, a marriage is going to encounter. You know, these are important lessons for our kids to see. And I think what my friend there, and I remember that interview very fondly, I think what he's saying is that, hey, guys, your kids are watching, and it's important that they see that the love and respect that you bring to the marriage in terms of handling all of your duties, but particularly the duties to your wife in a very responsible way. So, you know, if a kid sees his father mistreating his mother, you know, chances are that's going to become something that he says, well, that's the way it's done. That's a lesson I learned from dad. That's okay to do. You know, we want to be real careful in terms of the lessons that we're imparting.
Right. One question I have also, you know, you have single moms and, you know, the kids that are brought up without a father, and then maybe in your research, they were, some of them were maybe not raised by their biological father, but maybe by a stepdad, and stepdad comes in and maybe they have just a little bit of a relationship with biological father. You know, what type of role can a stepdad come in and play when, you know, he's the new guy coming in and into the single mom's home?
Yeah, that's tough. My brother, I watched him in that very same situation. He married a woman with three kids, you know, and it was not the easiest thing for him. Their biological father was completely out of the picture, but it was not an easy thing for him to step in. But he did it. You know, credit him for doing that and eventually adopting the kids and being a good dad. Some guys that I talked to were also in that situation, and some had it easier than others. One guy I remember saying, you know, you become more of a coach, I guess, when you're, you know, a stepdad, someone that perhaps the kids are going to listen to, but there's not a whole lot of thou shalt you can impart, you know, because they may not accept you as a guy who's, you know, trying to get them to toe the line and, you know, giving them orders and so forth. So maybe it's a more gentle touch. Maybe it's an acknowledgement that, you know, you're not the father and that there is a different relationship and you understand that, but nonetheless, you care for them, you love them, and you're going to give them whatever advice and counsel you can. So some guys were tiptoeing around that. I think that's a tough one. And depending on who you talk to, probably some guys are better than others in terms of the success that they have had doing.
Right. Well, where can our listeners get in touch with your organization, and where can they find your book?
Well, you can go to one place, and thank you for this opportunity to give a crass commercial plug, I guess. Yeah. Although I make absolutely no money on this thing, but there's a website, fathersfamilies.com, and that's the home of the nonprofit organization called Fathers and Families Inc. The book Fatherhood in Pieces is shown there on the website. You can also just go to Amazon and look up Fatherhood in Pieces, and it's out there if you want to take a look at that. But, you know, the website is there. We have, you know, the book. We have the videos that you talked about. I'm very happy that we have over 30 videos in what I call the dad episodes. And these are – it's a YouTube channel that we have that links to this. You know, these are pretty simple 2-minute, 3-minute videos of fathers, different fathers from the ones that are in the book. But other guys that I've known that, you know, we put on video, and they give some aspect of fatherhood, something that they think is important, a lesson perhaps, or just a piece of advice that I think is worth listening to if you're a young man, or, you know what, if you're a young woman, or even if you're a older father trying to do a better job, and maybe even a mother trying to do a better job, or trying to help her husband or the father of her children understand what this role is all about. But those videos are out there. And then something else, if I could just take another second. In addition to what we have at the dad episodes, we started something called the pro episodes. And that's where I've had the opportunity to go and talk to two different former professional football players. One is Gary Cobb. Those in Philly will know G. Cobb. He played for the Philadelphia Eagles and also for lesser teams like the Dallas Cowboys and the Detroit Lions. But a great guy.
Oh, don't say lesser teams. We're broadcasting out of Texas. They may come hunt you down.
I had a feeling you wouldn't like that one. So, but if I look at records, I have no business putting down the Dallas Cowboys. But nonetheless, you know, Gary Cobb has three interviews up there where he's talking about some aspect of fatherhood. He does a great job. And another one, Vince Papale. Vince, another former Eagle, and also the real-life inspiration behind the movie Invincible that some people will know, where Mark Wahlberg played Vince Papale. Well, Vince did – we have three videos of Vince, and he's talking about fatherhood. So, you know, obviously these guys have a passion for being a good dad. They're willing to talk, willing to give lessons and examples and speak up. And obviously they have a social media reach far beyond what I have myself, you know. So I'm real happy that we have some of those things that are on the website as well. Anyone can just go take a look and glean from any of those, whatever little tidbits you want to take away.
Well, thank you so much for being on. Again, Bill McCuster, founder and CEO of a nonprofit called Fathers and Families. It's called fathersfamilies.com if you want to go to the website. And then check out his book. As he said, you can get it there at the website, or you can go to Amazon, Fatherhood in Pieces. Bill, thank you so much for being on the show, and you are welcome back anytime.
I would love to do that again, Aaron. Thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Bill McCusker, a fabulous guest, and something that's so important, fatherhood, to boys and girls everywhere, being such a role model in their lives. So, you know, if you are a father out there, check out that site. It can't do anything but help you out, and it certainly can't hurt. So, again, fatherfamilies.com. And before we close, again, I'd like to say thank you to Bill. But it's always important to become a member of the political process. But being a part of the political process doesn't mean when your candidate loses or if you're angry that you take it out on others. That's not what we were founded upon as a country. That's called persecution. Your ancestors, my ancestors, came to America to avoid persecution. Don't do that to each other. That's why we have a judicial system. That's why we have the freedom to go vote and make a difference every single day. Be an active member of your community. Attend city council meetings. Start a nonprofit like Bill did. Make a difference in your community. Uplift your community. Don't destroy it. We're going to have another show on Sunday night. Sunday night at the same time, 8 o'clock. Thank you for joining us. And until Sunday, take care of each other. Again, uplift, don't destroy.